So when you talk on behalf of the British government, you were saying,
it was the British government, that's right, in the first place, at that time, he was at the height of his power, I think. And I'm going to mention in a moment, the French doctors, I wasn't supposed to know this, very deep secret, who came out and looked at his skin cancer, I think, came just at the time when McGoy left, and that was the beginning of it. And I think that may have started his internal doubts and debilitations, but I think, I don't know, but when I was there, most of the time I was there, he was at the height of his power. And didn't accept, not even from his own advisors, criticism of what he was doing in the country, wouldn't have accepted it from the British at that time, without resenting it, and taking it out of us in other forms. You very rightly say, why shouldn't we? The British government's responsibility to the British people was to maximise their interests, and that meant the exchequer and the balance of payments and all these things which for trade with Iran, very valuable. Why risk it by just giving gratuitous advice, if you like, to the Shah, when he might resent it and react accordingly? It wasn't worth their while at that time. It was only much later, towards the end of Tony Parsons' time, when they were urging him to conduct constitutional reforms of that kind. And when I was with the Shah, twice he tried to start an opposition party, which is a ludicrous thing to try to do. And just after when I was leaving, Mehdi Sami, of all people, who's such a splendid man, was asked to... he's well worth talking to, Mehdi Sami. I think he's one of the most sensible persons I know. He may not be a perched long personality, he's quiet and all that, but he's about the most sensible. That's around in London today. Balanced, I should say. At least he was. I'm not sure he hasn't gone off a little bit with Bakhtiar and all these people. I don't know. But poor little Mehdi was asked to start an opposition party. It was a ludicrous thing. He could run a bank better than anybody, but that wasn't his thing. So, all that. We weren't there giving advice to the Shah at all on that. I would talk around it. I would give advice. It might be Herveda with Asadullah and some, but not with the Shah. With the others, I'd give my personal advice. But with the Shah, by and large, unless I was answering or he was talking to me, I would come. If I had something to say to him, I would say it on instructions. Now, I might have got my own instructions by asking. I said, I propose to say this, that, and the other. Eric Hume was very good and gave me a very good free hand, I think. But on the whole, one didn't advise, nor did the American. I had three American ambassadors when I was there. I didn't think they would have given that advice. Maybe we should have done, but it wouldn't have been much good.
I wasn't thinking that you should have done it out of the kindness of your heart.
Well, no, I understand that.
As a long-term interest.
Well, maybe we should have done. I think we saw these things and we doubted them. And I think the way that we did it at all, would have been through those people like Asadullah. I would have done it with Asadullah, hoping that he would have a chance. Because the Shah really didn't encourage him to advise him too much on these things. He didn't take advice. And at least he... If he did, he didn't listen to it or want to listen to it. He was a very suspicious man. Didn't really trust people. So I never had that. I never had that chance. But the only advice I gave to the Shah, which could have saved a situation, as I think it could, I never really proved this, was right at the end of my time, when the oil price hike started. The OPEC price hike started. And it was in two tranches, I think, at the end of the end of 73, the time that they had the Arab-Israel war, they took advantage of it, and the Shah definitely led it, although he pretended he hadn't, to jump up the oil price. And then in January, I think it was, or a month or two later, they jumped it up again, and they quadrupled it, almost quintupled it, and caused very nearly a breakdown of the world economy as a consequence, because we never really, since then, know what happened. Dollar oil slushed around the world in an enormous, enormous amount, and it took all the international banks' wit and strength to manage. It took 3 or 4 years to absorb all that enormous rise in oil prices. We had to have oil rationing and all these things. Remember the consequences. A number of countries were nearly ruined through it. And of course the Shah and the other, the Persia and other countries got an enormous amount, quadruple revenues all at once. It was very nice for them. But the disaster, as we know, was twofold. one generally that all he succeeded in doing, was the main point, really, all he succeeded in doing was to create inflation for the first time in Persia, because he was importing goods. This policy of getting rich quick, of accelerating the industrialization of Persia, the modernity of Persia, which we just talked about, that policy was just beginning. Therefore, he had to spend large sums, all this money he had acquired, which he was quite able to do with this new money, in importing. But what he was importing was also doubling, trebling in price, because he forced that on the world. So he was importing his own inflation, and he started a very large, after I left, this was happening, heavy and large and growing inflation, which was beginning to upset very much the bazaar, on which, as you know, from Rustavik's day onwards and many years before, the power of the Shahs, of the regime, had depended, with other factors, the mullahs and the church and so on, and they started turning against it. The people who had been his supporters really before had grave doubts now about their future, because they were worried, they weren't used to this sudden surge of inflation of the middle class there, and it probably was one of the factors that brought him down to his own acts. It's rather like a Greek play, you know, very much like a Greek play. You could find parallels in Aeschylus with all that happened to the Shah, if you read it, somebody tried to analyze and write a book on it. And that was one factor that he did at the time. But I nearly, it sounds rather arrogant, and I think it is arrogant, and I don't think it really, if you look at the records, it wouldn't look like this. But I nearly stopped it. If I'd had American support, we might have, because at that time, I was seeing a lot of the Shah, and Dick Helms, who was a newly arrived, he had been head of the CIA, he was a newly arrived ambassador, became a great friend of mine, still is, had only just arrived. Of course, Americans had more power than we had in this sort of thing. But the State Department were still very hesitant because of the Sherman Act, because of the antitrust acts in America, in giving instructions, so to speak, to their oil companies. They kept away from that. We were less, particularly the British government had a share in BP, but we were less inhibited. We didn't have a Sherman Act, so we could give advice at least to them and discuss these things more closely. That was one inhibition that Helms suffered from also, and he was new, and I suppose the Shah hadn't known so well. And so he never got the instructions I wanted him to get, but what I wanted him to get was instructions that I got for myself, which was to go to the Shah. The Shah had been arguing with me, I must hike the prices up, because it's the only way in which I can match the inflation in other countries, and also the only way in which I can find the right level for the price of our oil, which should be the equivalent, and he had a whole packet, a basket of prices based on coal prices elsewhere to justify the increase in prices for himself and all that. And I said to the Shah, and he got instructions, look, if we can't dissuade you from doing this, at least to the level you're doing this, at least consider that you'd be much better off, instead of doing it now, he did it twice, do it over 4 years, spread your price over 4 years, it'll be better for you, you won't be importing inflation at the rate you will be importing inflation, you won't damage the whole economic structure of the world, the Western world, which is what you're about to do, which we told him, we warned him about, and you would be far more statesmanlike, and so on, and he didn't listen. And I maintain this is one of the ifs of history. Now, I may be quite wrong, although one has the fanciful ideas of my age, looking back without the records, that if I'd got Dick Helms to get the same instructions, if the American hadn't been inhibited by these other factors, Sherman Act and so on, and we'd gone in together very, very strongly, I don't see why we shouldn't have got the Shah to consider it. He said, I can't, he's gone too far, it's not just me, it's OPEC and Algeria, Venezuela and so on, but I think he could have done. And we would have changed the whole of the economic history of the 1970s.
First of all, was it simply the Sherman Act prevented the Americans from leaving, or were they just simply difficult to persuade?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't think we even tried to persuade them. I don't remember our Treasury doing very much. It all went so quickly, this. But looking back on it, there may be other factors. Looking back on it, I can't see why we really lined up together. Could it make sense? because he wanted the money quick. He pledged himself to OPEC.
Now, when you say that he confronted you with a set of facts and figures and that kind of thing.
They were very clever.
And they were clever, as you say. Well, somebody must have prepared those, because, I mean, he wasn't an economist, he wasn't a petrol expert. Somebody must have helped him. He must have had advisors.
Haveda would have helped him, because Haveda had been had grown up, you see, in IPC and in NIOC, and he knew about oil. It wasn't very difficult.
Did you put your project to him?
No, tried to retire with the Shah. But I should have known, because Haveda wasn't invited. I don't know who helped him. The Shah was perfect. The Shah did his own negotiations with the consortium for many years. He was an expert on it. The Shah, they would come to St. Moritz if he was there, or to Geneva or somewhere, negotiate. People like Page, who was the head of ESSO, one of the ablest negotiators I've ever met, head of one of the biggest oil company in the world. They would come and have lunch with me or something after. I mean, the Shah, with every match, was a match for these people. He understood, he knew the detail. One of my last things before I left, we were dealing with these little gas mounds, where you get gas out of the ground rather than oil, as a complicated negotiation. The Shah did it single-handed. He may have had Iqbal with him, but Iqbal didn't know anything like what the Shah did. The Shah was a remarkable man. He had almost total recall, personal recall. He worked 12 hours a day. He was quite an extraordinary man in that sense. Unbalanced in many respects and so on, but I mean, in terms of knowledge, when I was doing the chieftain tank arrangement agreements with the Shah, I'm hopeless at this sort of thing. I don't know any detail. And he used to, I'd been there very long, and the Shah would call me out, have me up there, and go through this, and there were the great big red books with all the details of the chieftain tank thing like that. And he read all the small print, and one absolute disaster was that he and the specifications that had originally been made before my time, I suppose you Danish, right? And his day, not him. There were some factors there, allowing for the tank to operate in the very hot deserts of the south, which weren't built into the tanks that we had in BOR and so on. It was a highly complicated electrical machinery. He discovered somewhere there that we hadn't made this specification, we hadn't made the allowance for it, and he practically blew up or cancelled the thing. But I had the experts with me. I've got his name now. He became a knight. Somebody knighted him for his efforts. The head of the Ministry of Defence sales side, who had come out, all his experts there, and they hadn't spotted this, and the Shah could talk to them all. See them all. And he used to, I remember one day I arrived, and he would say to me, an ambassador, he'd say, tell me, what is the sprocket horsepower of the chieftain tank? I didn't have even heard of a sprocket horsepower, you see. And by this time I was wiser, and I would say, Your Majesty, you know I'm hopeless at these things, you tell me. He liked that. He liked that, because that's what he really wanted, to show off, you see, his knowledge of all these things. So I always did that with him. I never tried to think, but then, but he had that extraordinary power. He was his own commander-in-chief. I remember very well, at the 1973, was it? We had the Shah over to London. I must tell you the story of how I got the Queen to invite him to Windsor Castle and what happened. It's a very interesting story. But the Shah came over to London. I think it was during that time. I came over, of course, too. Peter Carrington was Minister of Defence. And we sat in the bowels of the Admiralty. You know, that big underneath the Admiralty there. And all the top secret things were flashed onto the screen, the latest Jaguar, something, gun turret, and some other thing like that, all these things. It was like a man shopping at Harrods. He just sat there, you know, and said, I think I'll have one of those, one of those. Okay. We were 5 feet, so all we wanted to do, rather naughty then, I suppose, well, not naughty, I mean, it's a little to say, but I mean, all we were really concerned about was selling our arms, like the French and everywhere elsewhere, to a very rich man who bought them up, even though we knew he probably couldn't use them properly because the army wasn't sufficiently efficient to use these highly sophisticated weapons. Like that. But then we'd have a training team that would go out. Americans did it on a much larger scale with the Air Force. They had a monopoly, practically, with the English and the Air Force. But the Shah knew what he was about. He didn't have someone over his shoulder telling him to administer. I don't think he brought anyone with him, I don't remember. He knew. He was an expert on these things. On the Navy, the Shah took precautions every few years. He sacked the top four admirals in the Persian Navy in order to gain control. And he was ruthless. He behaved very badly to them, but he did it on purpose, so that there should never be a revolt. Later on, you see, you know, the admiral who tried to take over power later on, wasn't the one. After Khomeini, I think it was some admiral who it was always probably the Navy who was the most restless element there, the often is.
Are you thinking of Admiral Madani?
Probably, yes. And but I mean, I'm only mentioning that because I think the Shah had a particular suspicion, he must have had, because every few years he got rid of Rafai, or whoever it was it Rafai, head of the Navy, that's a nice chap, who arrived one day and found a chap at his desk and a taxi to take him away. It's that sort of thing which the Shah thought guaranteed him loyalty and total command. I don't think he minded so, I don't think he was so concerned with the army, because I think he had people at the top there, just as he had Nasiri, who was his own comrade from the past. About six people he really trusted, only six, if that. Sharpur, a reporter, because he'd played with him as a boy, you know, his father.
Sharpur?
Sharpur, you know. Do I mean Sharpur? Yes, Sharpur. Reporter, you know, so somebody reporter.
Oh, yes. Sir.
Sharpur reporter.
Who was in at the press office in London.
No, he was...
Sharpurian, wasn't he?
No, Sharpur reporter. We made him a knight, God knows why. He was the right-hand man of the Shah throughout the whole of these proceedings when I was there. Never heard of Sharpur. I mean, do I mean Sharpur? Yes. Reporter, his name was. His father was a reporter for the... was a Parsi, Zoroastrians. His father was a reporter. He trusted him. Asadullah Alam he trusted again because of the childhood reasons they brought up together. Ekbal, who stuck by him through thick and thin, he trusted. And Nasiri, maybe one or two others. But those are the only people he actually trusted, as far as he could trust anybody. So he trusted, I think, Savak and the army. He had someone he trusted there. The Navy he didn't very much. The Air Force was under his own son-in-law, of course. He was Fatima had married head of the Air Force.
Brother-in-law.
Otherwise, and he knew all the detail, and he was a very good pilot himself. When I sold the Concorde, I sold the three options of the Concorde to the Shah. He took the controls himself, the Shah, and flew down through the Persian Gulf.
Okay. So you flew to the south?
Yes, we flew to the south. This was, when I say I sold the Concorde, I should say, I mean, this was the process in which we, the British government, did sell three options of the Concorde to the Shah. We had the money. Well, with Heseltine, we threw to the south with the Shah. The Shah's brother was on board. Ali, what's his name? His older brother. Forgot his name.
The Shah's brother.
Brother, who did the? He was the great. You know, the great shot. He shot all wild animals, and he was the.
Prince.
Ali Reza.
Abdurreza.
Abdurreza was on board, and the Ghulam Reza, I think. And myself, and Heseltine, of course, who would come out with the Concorde. The first time, I think, the Concorde had flown a prototype as far as Persia, the Shah to see. So we left that wonderful airport, the Shah built himself with a little pavilion, which is the Royal Pavilion, and off we went. And we, and dear old, who just died now, the pilot, what's his name, Marvis man, who was the pilot, handed the controls over to the Shah, as a good pilot himself, and he flew at Mach 2, or whatever it was, beyond the speed of sound. He quite pleased. And, we had to start turning to come back, almost before we got to the Persian Gulf. It was going so quickly. And we came back, and we landed at Trumshaw. It was a marvellous man. Trumshaw just died. Great big fellow, like wrapped up in the Union Jack. He couldn't have been more English. And we arrived back again. And we got out and we went to the Royal Pavilion. There were the journalists, you see, and Persian journalists, very dutiful, they had to be. And the Shah was used to this sort of question. Did you enjoy your flight, Your Majesty? Yes, it was very enjoyable. Would you like to fly again? Well, I would like to fly again, that sort of thing. What the Shah had forgotten, and I perhaps hadn't told him, there were two British journalists out there. One was the Times correspondent, who did the unthinkable thing. He put his thing up and said, Your Majesty, do you intend to buy the Concorde? And the Shah was so surprised, he said yes. And that's how we sold three options to the Shah.
And why was, you said something about Heseltine behaving badly. In what way?
No, he didn't. I mean, I thought he was very arrogant as far as I was concerned, that's all. I expect ministers, especially junior ministers, to treat a senior ambassador rather better than he did. I think he was quite unaware of doing that. It was just my impression at the time, confirmed by recent events in January 1986.
What about, you said, I must tell you the story of how you got the Shah to come here and to go
to Windsor. Windsor, yes. Would you like me to do that now or after that?
No.
You probably exhausted my repertoire, I don't know. But this was a different story, and a much longer one, so we may not take it on the tape. That in 73, one of the policy changes in the British government at the time was a retreat from east to Suez. And it's been begun earlier on, but we were no longer, we've been declining in power ever since Suez itself in 56, and had to give up our Indian Ocean fleet and had to withdraw from Aden and whole factors. And now the time had come where we could no longer felt that we could have responsibility, defense responsibility, for the crucial states and for all our little shakedom that we were responsible for. And we wanted to convert that relationship into one of treaties of association and friendship and so on, and not of defense. Which meant, really, that the defense, the power that would defend the Gulf, Persian Gulf, would no longer be in British hands. And the Shah, who exaggerated everything, was particularly concerned that his lifeline for his oil, which was his lifeblood, going down through the Gulf, would be at the mercy of Iraq, or even right down at the Straits of Hormuz, where it narrows there. Anyone could hold him to ransom there. And I remember he used to argue with me, for example, the Israelis, I think, a year before, with a bazooka, had held something to ransom on some island or something or other, and he said anybody with bazookas in one of the islands in the middle of the Gulf could hold us to ransom and all that, and I must have control when you give up, hand over to the crucial states and make the United Emir Republic, United Emirate Republics, UAR, URE, what's it? UAR. I forgot what it is now. I ought to know because I had a hand in the whole thing. When you do that, you must make sure that I must be certain that I can control and my own defences down there, the Gulf. Jabal Ha is all right, but what happens further up? There were two islands in the middle there. One called Abu Musa. Abu Musa. There was a and the Tums. Abu Musa was an island off the sheikhdom of Sharjah, almost in the middle of the Gulf. And the Tums, the greater Tums, the lesser Tums, further down, also almost in the middle of the Gulf. As I say, Abu Musa Island was quite a biggish one, a biggish island, belonged to the Sheikh of Sharjah. The two Tums belonged to the Sheikh of Ras Al Khaimah. Nobody ever heard of him, but he's now part of the Abu Dhabi, Dubai, you know, all that. And on the lesser Tums, there was practically empty, nothing at all. They were just rocks, really. On the larger Tums, there was a lighthouse and a few Indians sweltering about 120 in the shade, and a lot of snakes, that was all it was. And they belonged to the Sheikh of Ras Al Khaimah. And the British were responsible for the defense on his behalf. We held that position, one of our defense treaties. So the time was coming when we were announcing we were going to withdraw. And the Shah wanted to make sure that he held that control. And all the maps, which had been drawn, of course, in the past by people from the Indian Army up there, the Admiralty, were all British maps. And they showed that these islands belonged to Sharjah and Ras Al Khaimah. The Shah disputed that and said they really belonged to his ancestors or somebody's ancestors and so on, which is not true. But he had no proof. So the problem was what we were going to do about these islands when we withdrew, because the Shah would have then gone to war and entered with the troops. A lot of people would have been killed and we'd have been responsible as usual and that sort of thing. Finally, the outcome was we had endless negotiations with the Shah. He used to make us go all the way up to his palace in the Caspian to do these negotiations. On and on and on, threatening all the other way, you know, that he'd cut off this contract and this, that, and the other. Finally, not long, but the day before, I can't remember exactly, we were due to leave. The treaties of defense were going to be converted to treaties of association. On instructions, this one, we may have devised them for ourselves, on instructions, I went to see the Shah, and rather casually, talking about other things, told him 24 hours. He didn't know. Nobody knew when this was. I told him, I gave him 24 hours before we were going to actually move out. Although I think officially we may have blurred the issue and said it would be later. And that was enough. And the next day, he sent his Shafiq's son, who was assassinated, I think, later on. He sent him down with some of the hovercraft, which we'd sold him, incidentally, and took Abu Musa and the two tombs and landed their men, and he rewarded all the admirals with them. Well, I think one Indian was killed or something like that. Everyone was awarded great victory and terrific things like that. It was all done, and we always pretended to look surprised that the Shah had done this, but it was all, that was how we solved it. And the Sheikh of Russell came out, was terribly upset, and we said, I'm terribly sorry, this could have happened, and all that sort of thing. It was all slightly, I mean, it wasn't very honest, but it was any way we could solve the thing, so it was solved like that. And we thought that was it. Fine, we've solved this thing, which really occupied a lot of my time. But, not a bit of it, then, not very long after, Iraq, I think it was, was incensed by all that had gone on, you see, summoned Iran to the Security Council with a case against Iran. And the Shah suspected that we were behind it. When everything went wrong, we were behind it, thought that somehow we were behind this. And everything was going wrong again, and our relations were going to go bad again. Then I had the bright idea, I think it was me, but I don't know if you can remember these things. I threw Alec Hume. We asked the Queen if she would invite the Shah and the Shah Banu to come and spend Ascot weekend with them at Windsor. And they did. Now this was something which neither the Kremlin, nor the Elysee, nor the White House could conceivably do. They could not have even, they couldn't do this. Only the Queen could do this. The Shah was in seventh heaven. He rode down Ascot in open carriage, that lovely thing with all the crowds cheering, with the Shah Banu and the Queen on his side. He had this marvellous time. Hurry with pleasure, forgot about his music, things like that, everything was marvellous. The Queen, I wrote and thanked her because it was such a sacrifice, because Ascot weekend is very important for the Queen when she has all her family there, and they play charades and family games and all that good writing, but then she had to sacrifice a lot of that, because he's not the most amusing of men, you know, and she had to do all that, and she did it. And she did it for the national cause, and it made all the difference. This is one justification for the royal family, at least with their castles and things, that nobody knows about. And during that evening, we had this big dinner beforehand, where everything was produced. I mean, the silver that hadn't been seen on Windsor Castle table. Everyone was there, every member of the royal family except Snowden was there, Queen Mother, Charles, everybody, and Francis and me. And all the members, you know, their special uniform they wear, very smart. And after dinner, we were always rather late, by this it was marvelous dinner. Afterward, the Queen took us round the apartments, which are not even shown to the private viewers, and which the Queen's librarian had got out specially with cases with examples of Persian manuscripts, which hadn't seen the light of day for a long time, far better than anything the Shah had, or the British Museum. You know, the Queen has all these marvellous things from the past. And the Shah, the Shah Bonnet, the Shah, you know, that great work of the 12th century. The Shah Nameh.
Book of Kings.
Book of Kings, which she had some pages of and all that. We wandered round, just the royal family chatting, with Princess Margaret making amusing remarks to the Shah about it, showing examples of her sister's baby handwriting, all that sort of thing went on, you see. And about midnight or later, the Queen beckoned me and said, the plan is that he and I should go riding in Windsor Park tomorrow morning before we go to Ascot, that he and I should ride, and she goes off with her, about doing all that other thing. Can you give me some advice? Well, unlike Dennis Wright, I'm not a rider, I mean, used to ride with the Shah, but I did remember, I said, man, the Shah, like many Persian men, will really ought to ride a stallion. A Persian man is not their dignity to ride a gelding or mare, and they like what they must ride stallions. That's the dignity of the Persian. It doesn't apply in England over, but that's how it is. Oh, the Queen said, now that's very awkward. Now, I don't have a stallion in my stable. Then she said, ah, yes, but Anne, her daughter, Anne has a stallion, and I think we'll be able to mount him for the Shah. And then she said, with a twinkle in her eye, there's this one problem there. I hope that doesn't matter, she said. The stallion's name is Cossack. The Shah's father was a Cossack. And she knew she made them. So I said, I don't think, perhaps you won't have to mention it now, I said. And that's how they did. They went riding the next morning. And I wrote to thank her. It was a great, really big sacrifice she made.
Did she tell you what they talked about as they went riding?
No, but she had. I talked to the Queen on a number of occasions about the Shah. You know, she came to Tehran once when I was there, and so we talked about it. And she meets him. She'd met him several times before then, on funerals, you know, royal funerals. You meet them. He is just, and she finds him an immensely boring man, she found him, because he had no small talk, you see. He doesn't want to talk about new factories in Kerman or something all the time. She found him very boring. Well, boring, but not, I mean, he's not a man for a woman to talk to like that. Not for a long time, in half an hour. It's very interesting. She can learn in half an hour all she wishes to know, or has need to know about what the population rises, and what they're doing with that and the other, you know. So there was nothing beyond that. And as far as I know.